Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. I'm your host again this week. This is, of course, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. And we have some great guests to get to shortly. We have Alyssa Knight from Maite Group coming up and Henry Ma, the CIO of WeBank. And that's some of the stats behind that WeBank, the largest challenger bank in the world. I'm sorry, Tom Blomfield. I'm sorry, Revolut. I'm sorry, guys. These guys are undisputably the largest challenger bank in the world. We'll get to that in the second half of the show. But before we get to that, a little bit of fintech news around. Ripple is being accused of making false claims about Swift error rates in their marketing. So that's a little controversial. TD Bank, a partner of Moovin, of course, is now empowering the mobile app with AI. They have, of course, did an acquisition of Layer 6, a 20-man AI startup, an acqui-hire, so reportedly for around $100 million back in 2018. That's led by my good pal Rizwan Kalfan, the CDO out at TD. If you see some of the other data and some of the other news coming out, we see Visa has invested in a form of ultrasonic data transmission, looking at ways to do transactions that don't require a physicality or a physical interaction, whether that's a contactless tap from a few centimeters or a couple of inches away, or whether that is the swipe of the card. We're sort of abandoning that modality that you need to come in contact with a point of sale. And in fact, the point of sale is at risk itself if you look at what's happened in the Chinese market. Talking about the Chinese market, huge, huge news from Ant Financial that just broke today, which is Ant Financial has launched a version of its Alipay app designed for foreign visitors to China. So they can link, previously you had to have a Chinese bank account or, you could, some Asian banks were in the Alipay network, such as some of the Hong Kong banks and so forth. But now visitors can download the app to their iOS and Android device and use a tour pass feature, essentially enabling a prepaid service from a Bank of Shanghai. And you can use your international debit card or credit card to top that up. With RMB. And so that's huge news. This is the largest mobile wallet service in the world, of course, now in 100 countries with 1.2 billion users, according to Ant Financial. So that's some pretty big news out of the gate there for Alipay. I've made the prediction before. I think we will all by 2030 have a Chinese mobile wallet in our phone. We may have something else as well, but I think they're, the traction on that system, you've heard me talk about it before. I wrote about it in Bank 4.0. It's here to stay. All right, so let's get to our first guest. In the field of cybersecurity, hacking, and so forth, it's a fairly small field, and so it's my great pleasure to introduce Alyssa Knight. Alyssa is with Maite Group, and she's also the author of Hacking Connected Cars, Tactics, Techniques, and Procedures, a book that was published or will be released in paperback in 2020. Alyssa, I assume it's otherwise available, is it now?
Yeah, I get people emailing me all the time asking when it's coming out. They're just waiting for it to be released. It's been pushed back so many times now. I apologize.
They want to hack cars. Or?
It is the first field manual on hacking cars remotely over GSM and risk assessments of connected cars. So it's a fairly complete book. I would. The people who reach out to me are penetration testers of right. connected connected cars and want to get
the hacking cars. Otherwise known as what we'll call white hat hackers.
Yes, yes, or ethical hackers or
ethical
white hats.
Ethical hackers, yeah, correct. White hats, yeah. As compared with black hat or unethical, you know, dark web type hackers. But
Malicious.
And so do you introduce yourself as a hacker at parties?
I did. You know, it's definitely bragging rights at cocktail parties.
Yeah, I think so.
I introduced myself as a recovering hacker of 20 years.
A recovering hacker.
I've fallen off the wagon a couple of times. But other than that, I'm good.
When someone messes with you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and then everyone quickly turns their phone off, right?
So. Now, because more recently in your role as a senior industry analyst for ITE, and for those of you not familiar with ITE Group, ITE is a research house primarily focused on financial services. And so I assume you're deep into financial services these days from a perspective of cybersecurity and overall threat assessment.
I am. I'm very intrigued by, you know, payment processors and financial services in general and targeting them as an adversary. So banks will hire me to hack into their networks, target their API servers, target their mobile apps in order to identify vulnerabilities so they can fix them before the bad guys find them. So, you know, I've been approached by several large banks to also do penetration testing of their commercial payment processors, that sort of thing. So it's really interesting. It's definitely, to me, sort of this new frontier, right, where we're really in this new API-first world. And I just left Money 2020 where I was speaking there. And, you know, I heard a great quote that someone said that, you know, banks are no longer just banks. They're technology companies now, you know,
they spend billions in some cases on technology annually.
Exactly. So. Yeah. And now, you know, with PSD2 and open banking and that data becoming now available and consumable over APIs, you know, they're definitely becoming more tech companies than your traditional bank.
So what were you talking about in Money 2020?
So I recently just published some research on hacking banks through their mobile apps. So what happened was, I consider myself to be a content creator and an influencer in cybersecurity. So, you know, very much more than just an analyst. And so vendors will approach me to have them write a white paper on their technology. And so a company called Arxin Technologies contacted me and said, hey, look, you know, we have this in-app protection solution that will basically allow you to obfuscate your mobile code so hackers can't download your mobile app and reverse engineer it. Well, the thing is, there's a lot of secrets in those mobile apps, like API keys, tokens, credentials, and a lot of companies just publish their mobile apps to the Play Store or the Apple Store thinking that nobody can reverse engineer it or reverse it back to the source code and see those secrets.
Right.
Well, what I wanted to do was prove the efficacy of this product by doing that. So I downloaded 30 financial services mobile apps, and I was shocked by the findings. I found hard-coded payment, you know, hard-coded tokens, hard-coded credentials, credentials, you know, even tokens.
Like private keys and everything,
yeah,
right?
Private keys with no passwords.
Wow.
And we're talking about keys for the third parties like S3 buckets, AWS, Salesforce. You know, third-party payment processors, P2P Gosh. Money transfer. It's crazy. It definitely was a lot worse than I thought it would be when walking into it. But so I was at Money 2020 talking about that research. And then I also was talking about this fake bank decoy net that I created. So, so I've created a fake bank. So, you know, the whole Sun Tzu art of war thing, right? In order to defeat your enemy, you need to know your enemy. Well, I figured, right. how do you best understand how adversaries are targeting and breaking into bank APIs? What if we were to create this massive fake bank decoy net in the AWS cloud and with those APIs facing the internet so we can study how these adversaries are breaching these APIs. And so we've created this massive decoy net with a technology stack with different vendors. And the interesting thing about it is the data is actually fanged, it's weaponized. So when the data is downloaded by the adversaries, it actually executes this code and we get the information on their system, their GeoIP stuff. So a lot of really
sort of like a rat.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. And then the other interesting thing is it's actually got these container backends. So we're actually able to study how adversaries are actually busting out of containers and pivoting within containerized environments. So it's a really nerdy, extremely sexy project. So I'm really excited to be a part of it. We've got some great companies who are involved as sponsors in it. We're going to be learning a lot of really cool things. I'll be on the speaking circuit in 2020, like RSA 2020, and other conferences speaking about the findings from the Decoy Net. So it should be fun.
Very interesting. And you said you're a content creator. So I know you publish on LinkedIn. That's where I've read some of your stuff. But where else do you publish?
Yeah, I actually host two podcasts. I also have a weekly vlog. I also publish on, like you said, LinkedIn. I also am one of few people with a homepage still. If you remember GeoCities. But I do actually have a homepage and also a YouTube channel. So yeah, and also Instagram TV. So I'm pretty much on
everything
but Snapchat. I'm ubiquitous, yes. And Twitter. I've definitely got myself.
All right, well, we'll get you to give us your Twitter ID before we finish so people can track you down. All right, so tell me about your work with IT Group. Now, do you produce reports for them? Are you doing some of the sort of penetration test, ethical hacker stuff for them, or is it more research based?
So the answer is definitely all of the above. What's I think unique about me is, and please don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that traditional analyst who writes the typical analyst report isn't needed. I think those analyst firms, those are definitely, there's some brilliant analysts who work at IT Group who it's an honor to work as beside. I'm this, I think, merger of a traditional analyst, a hacker, content creator, an influencer in one, is sort of the Swiss Army knife where, I do the typical market reports, so this is give you an idea of my content calendar and how this works. So vendors will either contract us for me to write a white paper for them. So, we'll put the logo on it, we'll write the typical pipe, we'll write the white paper, the ebook, and they will have, distribution rights of that report. Then I'll also create market reports. So, for example, I'm in the process of creating two new market reports before the end of the year, one on security orchestration solutions and another one on API security gateways. So I'll also write the typical market report where I'll look at all the vendors in the space, compare and contrast them, and really just provide information to buyers on, how the solutions work and the adoption, the care and feeding that's required after it's implemented, that sort of thing. And then now the other interesting thing, I think that's sort of new for IT Group, and they're still trying to figure this whole thing out, is banks are contracting us to do penetration testing of their networks. So they'll see me speak at a show, or they'll see my research that I'll publish around the things like the mobile banking or the API security vulnerabilities. And they'll contact IT Group and say, hey, we want to listen to hack our network. We want to listen to hack our mobile apps, and that sort of thing. So I think it's sort of this new frontier that IT Group is navigating and trying to figure out how do we do this? So I've definitely broken the mold in many sense of the word. I was the first hire in the cybersecurity practice. The cybersecurity practice has definitely grown since I came on a year ago. We've just added Joseph Kroll, and we're also adding a third analyst. So the practice is growing. It's seeing a great deal of demand in financial services.
Yeah, not surprising given that, as you said, banks are becoming technology companies and much more reliant on this technology. Right. So I'm very interested in the book that you've got coming out. I'd like to talk about that for a moment before we come back to financial services.
Sure.
So you've got this piece on hacking connected cars. And really looking at identifying vulnerabilities so that vehicle makers can, can limit exposure on that. Now, we've got cars now that are increasingly connected. Probably the best example of a connected car is the Tesla vehicles, where they actually can do updates, operational updates to the way the car works, software updates, which they can stream, because every Tesla vehicle has access to their network. And so this is sort of a template for how cars are going to be, particularly as we get into more autonomous driving and have more features built into the car around wide tech. But how did you go about the process of researching this?
Yeah, so great question. And one thing I do want to mention, Brett, is a lot of people, I think there's this misperception, with a lot of people that in order to have a connected car to worry about these vulnerabilities, you really need a Tesla, right? But the General Motors actually brought the first connected car to market.
Right, with the OnStar. Yeah. In fact, do you remember that Arnie movie, The Sixth Day, with the clones?
Yeah.
They featured OnStar as like a future autonomous driving capability. Did you remember?
Yeah, and it was actually, so it was the Cadillac DeVille. The first car to come out connected in 1996 was the Cadillac DeVille. And it's interesting. And I think it was actually there was the Seville and there was also the Eldorado. But it was a lot of people think like, oh, I don't need to worry about this. My family is safe. I don't have a Tesla. But anything purchased after 96 is connected. But back to your question about the research, I actually moved out to Stuttgart, Germany, to open a new security operations center for the company that I was the group CEO of, called Breyerthorn. And we moved out to Germany to service multiple contracts with clients that we had gained in the automotive industry who needed us to secure their fleet of connected vehicles. And so I worked very closely with a lot of manufacturers, automobile makers, and OEMs in the Stuttgart corridor and automotive corridor, and started penetration testing telematics control units, which is basically the communications gateway for connected cars, and infotainment systems. So that was really where I started cutting my teeth. A lot of that experience that I gained in penetration testing for a lot of those automotive makers really formed the narrative for this book. And so a lot of this book, what's very different about this book compared to others on the, other books that have been published in the market, is it actually has empirical data from real penetration tests in it. So I take all of those lessons learned from 10 years of penetration testing connected cars to this book. And so the neat thing about this book is actually broken up into two parts. So the first part is on penetration testing, and the second part is actually performing risk assessments. And the thing about this book that I really enjoyed about writing it was that if you go out there and Google this stuff, there really isn't much stuff out there about hacking connected cars. There really isn't many how-tos or informative guides or white papers on how to do this. There's superficial. There is some information out there at a superficial level. You'll find some YouTube videos out there, but there's nothing that really tells you from cradle to grave how to perform penetration testing, what to do at each step in the process. And so this book actually is about 2 years in the making. We're in on final copyright edits at this point, So we're doing all the copy editing. It's funny. I anyone listening who's planning on writing a book, do not think that you can walk into it and go, I'll kick out one chapter a week, because that's what I thought. No.
So this is your first book?
This is my first book.
Yeah, it's a different process.
You walk into it just thinking like, oh, this is going to be awesome. I'll kick this book out one in 1 month. I'll write, several chapters a day. No.
It's 6 months after you submit the final draft manuscript that it goes out.
Yeah.
Typically. Because, you got three or four rounds of edits. They each take about a month, depending on whether you do this full time. And then you got to wait till it gets actually physically printed. Because they don't release ebooks before they release your hardcover or your paperback, because that would affect the sale of the physical book. So they wait. They normally run the paperback first, and then we'll launch the Kindle edition maybe a few weeks later.
Yeah, you're an author. You know all about this.
Yeah.
Bank 4.0, right?
I'm working on number 7 right now. I should be getting good at it by now, they tell me.
Well, you know, it's funny. I walked in it so arrogant, like, oh my God, you know, I'm gonna write a chapter a day. I'm gonna get this thing done in 10 days.
I tell you who really, you know, I've had him on the show a couple of times, Kevin J. Anderson, who's written hundreds of books. He's got, I don't know how many New York Times bestsellers he's got, but it's in the dozens, if not more than 100. But what's crazy is he dictates a lot of his books on a little tape recorder. Someone transcribes them. And I'm like, I can't even imagine doing that.
Oh, my God.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, well, it's funny because I read several books in the process of this, right? So on writing books while I'm writing my first book. And one of the best things that, you know, that I heard, and I believe it was Stephen King who said this, is that you don't just wake up with this inspiration to write. And I really walked into it thinking that, I'm going to just wake up each morning wanting to write. You have to be very deliberate and really ritualize this. It needs to be habitual. You have to force yourself to write. You know, get this inspiration to write. You just have to force yourself
to
write.
And what a lot of people don't realize is that what you see is the finished book. At least from my point of view, you know, and I know different authors have different processes, but for me, the first draft is what helps me understand the book that I'm writing. And so then, you know, the second and the third drafts, particularly of like the first chapter, which is sort of foundational. But I will find the structure of the book evolves. I'll find I have a book plan that I stick to. But, you know, writing the book is in itself an evolutionary process as, you know, particularly if it's research based or data based like yours would be, where as you uncover more and more data and you're building the thesis for the book, you know, it might even change the directionality. So
as Anne Hanley says, you know, the ugly first draft, it's literally bullet points. It's bullet
but you
points
need it and, you need that you don't get to the finished product without that. So so tell me about some of the organizations that you would rate fairly highly around the world on the cybersecurity side within banking and financial services.
Oh, you know, I hate name dropping. I will.
All right.
I will
then tell me what makes a good secure institution.
Okay, that's a better question. Okay, yeah. I will tell you this: out of the 30 financial services mobile apps that I tested, the one financial institution that really did a good job with its cybersecurity posture around its mobile app and API was a German bank. I was very shocked, but it was actually a German bank. So the thing I can tell you is that the quintessential perfect, you know, bank that's got it together when it comes to this kind of stuff is making sure that their mobile app can't be easily reverse engineered by using an in-app protection solution like ArcSan, like something that will obfuscate the code. It's called application shielding. And it basically takes your mobile app and it runs it through several obfuscation techniques and applies white box encryption to private keys and API keys like tokens, just really sensitive things that you don't want just floating out there, that sort of thing. Another thing is making sure that the bank has implemented what's called an API security gateway. So a lot of organizations will make the mistake of putting their APIs behind a web application firewall. treating it like a web server because it speaks the HTTP protocol. Right. But you need something more than that. The, you know, WAFs are looking for things like SQL injection and traditional, what I call legacy sort of attacks against web applications. An API needs more than that. You need to not only just authenticate, but also authorize. And so you want something that says, hey, you know, just because Brett has this API key doesn't necessarily mean that Brett should be accessing that data, right? So the authentication is valid, but that individual or that process or that app shouldn't be authorized to actually see it.
Oh. And so identifying, like heuristics, keying it to certain individuals from an identity or device access point. There's other ways we can practically do that to secure, user-based apps. But hey, listen, Alyssa, we're running out of time, so I do want to wrap it up. But okay. Let me ask you this. How do people, first of all, they can check out the new book coming out on Amazon. They can pre-order it for a February release, Hacking Connected Cars, Tactics, Techniques, and Procedures. But how can they follow you on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. Yeah. They can follow me on Twitter at Alyssa Knight. It's AlyssaKnight. And I'm also on LinkedIn.
Very good. Well, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today. Very enlightening. And we'll follow up when the book comes out.
Thanks for having me on the show, Brett.
Okay, guys. Well, we're about to go to a break. After the break, you'll hear my interview with Henry Ma, the CIO of WeBank. We'll be right back after these short words from our sponsors. Hey guys, my life runs on my smartphone, my mobile phone, getting access to emails, messaging, messaging systems, social media, all this sort of stuff. I'm using this every day. But if you're on mobile every day, like I am, and if you're still using one of the big wireless providers here in the United States in 2019, you need to ask yourself, what exactly are you paying for? Between the expensive retail stores, the inflated prices, the hidden fees, you're being taken advantage of because these guys know you have no choice but to pay. But now you do. Enter Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile provides the same premium network coverage, premium data coverage that you're used to with the big guys, but at a fraction of the cost because everything they do is online. Mint Mobile saves on retail locations and overhead, then passes those savings directly on to their customers. For me, what makes a difference in Mint Mobile's plan is instead of paying a premium for unlimited data you'll never use, you can choose your own data plans. You can choose between 3 gigs a month, 8 or 12 gigabytes of data a month across their 4G LTE networks. And for me, it's all about the data, folks. That's what really drives me. But get this. Mint Mobile just charges you $15 a month. Unlimited nationwide talk and text, and you choose the data package you want. $15 a month. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan. You keep your same phone number. Obviously, you keep your contacts. You ditch your old wireless bill. Start saving with Mint Mobile. So to get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped straight to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/fintech. That's mintmobile.com/fintech. And cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/fintech.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
So if you've been watching the news, this big fintech season, we have had, of course, Money 2020. Prior to that, we had Sibos and Finovate. And this week in Asia, we have a bunch of things happening. So we have the Hong Kong Fintech Week. We have the Singapore Fintech Festival. And at the heart of the disruptive changes going on in fintech and banking in the space
is the largest challenger bank or largest neobank in the world, based out of Shenzhen in China, known as WeBank. And we're very fortunate today to have the EVP and Chief Information Officer, CIO, from WeBank, Henry Ma. Henry and I have met numerous times. Prior to working at WeBank, Henry served as the GM at Ping An Technology. He was with Ping An for 12 years. And prior to that, he spent 10 years in Silicon Valley. So, Henry Ma, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you, Brad. Delighted to be able to join this morning.
Now, WeBank is on fire, Henry. You know, you guys have had an extraordinary few years. But before we get to a little bit of the stats and a little bit of the data behind what's happening with WeBank today, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the foundation story. Who came up with the idea for WeBank? When was it, and how did you guys get started?
Well, first of all, thanks for the kind compliment. I think we actually started a little more than 5 years ago when Chinese government started to release the so-called privately funded banking license. And we are one of the first banks to get the license. When we started this new venture, the bunch of us actually think about, like, what do we want to do? I mean, there are already more than 4,000 banking licenses being issued in China. If we want to create an additional one, I mean, are we going to do the traditional way, or are we going to build a totally different business model? So at that moment, we think about, like, what is the gap in the market? I mean, what are the customer segments that are being underserved currently by the existing financial services available? Even though the account penetration in China is already pretty high, almost like 80-90% of the population already got a bank account, but a lot of them, like individual consumer or micro SMEs, they still have difficulty getting access to credit facility. So we feel like that may be a good starting point. Essentially, it's promoting the kind of concept of financial inclusion in the Chinese market. And when we think about doing it, it feels like we have to do it in quite a different way, because if you like go for the brick and mortar kind of approach, the cost structure is not going to make that sustainable. So that's why we feel like it's actually better to try to see if we can leverage technology to drive down the cost and be able to serve the market, which is highly underbanked or even unbanked. So that's the beginning of our story.
And so that was back in 2014, correct?
That was back in 2014. So at the end of 2014, we got the license. And then starting right after that, we started thinking about how to build out the technical architecture and also think about what are the kinds of products that we want to offer to the market.
Now, of course, you're very connected in the technology scene there, but also the financial services scene. But tell me about the core team. Was this, you had early support from Tencent, but how important were they to the ideation of WeBank? Or was that more that your team sort of came together and pitched this to the Tencent team?
They are a very important element to WeBank, because they are the founding shareholder of WeBank. And also, right from the beginning, I think they actually contribute a lot in terms of a lot of the technical expertise to run a underlying banking infrastructure at scale, to be able to support the kind of scale that we anticipate and now also being realized. So from the beginning, we already got a lot of the technology DNA from Tencent. And the team, the founding team itself, we also have a very good exposure and experience in the financial industry. I myself and also our chairman and the president, they all come from traditional banks or financial institutions. So with the experience in financial industry, together with the genetic makeup being injected from Tencent, we actually come up with quite a different types of organization. We emphasize a lot on technology, and at the same time, we also understand, you know, the logic and the compliance requirement in the financial world. So in a way, we kind of create a new breed of organization.
Indeed.
And being able to, you know, really try to build out a new type of bank, which is asset-light, and also have very strong emphasis on technology. Essentially, when we were actually given the license, we were being allowed to open up one single outlet. And after like long hours of discussion among the senior management team, we actually decided to go with zero branch. So,
yes.
Because when we first thought about like building the business model that we want to go forward with, we feel like if we build a branch, that will actually put additional burden in terms of how we build out our systems, how we build our team. Because if you have a single branch, you still need to staff up a lot of the operation side of the business, right? So we want to go like totally 100% straight through processing, fully
yes.
automated. So
you want to avoid the complication of having branch systems and all of those issues.
Exactly,
that you
exactly.
have, yeah.
Right. So we trim down a lot of the requirements and get ourselves focused on the very, very important part of how we run a very efficient underlying banking system to support the kind of scale that we anticipated.
And I think this is a really important point, because as we talk about the scale you guys have achieved, what's going to become clear is this purpose of design was very critical to your ability to scale up on your future success. And for those of you listening in the United States, for example, this is not possible in the United States. There's no regulatory structure that allows this type of bank operating model. You must have at least one branch in the United States based on the current licensing architecture, which really it means that if you're starting a challenger or a digital bank in the United States today, you're going to have one hand tied behind your back because of those restrictions. So 2014, it all starts off. Henry, what did you guys launch out of the gate? What were the first services that you launched with to the market?
Right. In 2015, the very first product that we launched to the market is the micro lending facility that we offer to WeChat and QQ users. You know, WeChat and QQ, they are the most like popular social media platform in China. So we are talking about over a billion of active daily user. Right. So, and we feel like that's actually a very good penetration point. So we decided to embed a micro lending facilities for WeChat and QQ Wallet users. So based on a lot of the underwriting criteria, we select a bunch of QQ users and WeChat users and invite them to become our micro lending customers. So when they get invited, I mean, they will see a red dot in their wallet, and then when they click on it and give their consent, basically we grab data from other publicly available data sources, and then do our computation, and then give them a line of credit. The whole process only takes maybe a few minutes, including yeah. the time when they have to punch in their personal data. So
now you make it sound pretty simple.
Yes, we want to make the experience totally very streamlined, very smooth for the users. And once they get the line of credit, they will be able to do drawdown anytime, 7/24. And then we ensure the money will be able to be deposited into their bank account within minutes.
How many of these customers would you classify as unbanked, that had never had a traditional relationship with a bank?
In fact, a large portion of them are the so-called the blue-collar worker, and they may not be that highly educated. So I'll give you a few numbers, right? 75% of our customer base for that particular product, they are non-white-collar. I mean, so these are the so-called, like, basically the brand-new bank customers. And once they start borrowing from WeBank, they will be able to accumulate credit history in the credit bureau, and later on when they try to like borrow from another bank for the mortgages or car loan, etc.,
they have
it would
history
be
now.
Actually much easier yeah. for them to actually borrow from another traditional bank afterwards.
But this is really important, because you were creating a new market that conventional banks would normally have not have touched because they would have perceived it as too risky because they don't have the data to make a credit risk assessment. But you guys knew credit models because you'd been in the finance industry, but you came up with a unique data approach to measure that risk in a different way. You mentioned you looked at other data sources. If they didn't have credit bureau records, what was the sort of data that you'd use to assess credit risk or even just to assess that this person was real?
Well, first of all, we work closely with WeChat and QQ, and we basically analyze some of the so-called social behavior, but we don't really look into the individual contents of those conversations. But we emphasize on actually like how stable their social circle is, and that actually is a very good indication of their whether that particular person is a real person. Or is it really like a potential fraud? That actually takes away a lot of the fraud risk. And on top of that, I mean, if we can, based on the information, the ID number, the name being provided by the customers once they give us the consent, we also query the credit bureau to check on their credit history. And at the same time, we also get access to some of the public data, for example, like their education level, the gas, the electricity bill payment history. And based on those data, we actually input into our model and compute a credit score for that particular person and determine the line of credit that we want to grant to that user. So this is basically the process. But the important thing is
very similar to the cred score that we came up with for Moovin back in 2012.
Yeah, yeah. All that is based on the consent of the customer, so this is very important. And at the same time, I think we really want to look at objective data instead of just decorative data. If you look at like traditional banks, I mean, they require the customer to fill out a lot of forms. You know, the customer have to declare what their income level is, what their family situation is. But a lot of those information, I mean, is decorative, may not be totally accurate. But on the other hand, like what we are looking at is very objective data and use those data to predict their credit behavior. Turns out is the end result is actually very satisfactory because if you look at the end of the year NPL rate in 2018, it's only 0.51%.
Wow,
I mean, we're talking about
that's incredible.
Totally unsecured loan, right? But also, like because of the fact that the ticket size that we are talking about is very low, I mean, the average ticket size for that consumer lending product is only around 8,000 RMB, so equivalent to just something above 1,100 USD.
Yeah.
And the average tenure is very short. I mean, we're talking about only 50 days. So even though the customers are being presented the options to repay the loan in either 5, 10, or 20 installments, most of them actually decided to pay back early. Because because we charge them interest on a daily basis.
Right.
The
so they were going to
pay the less interest they will be paying us, right? So that's also good for the customer because it's becoming more transparent, right? And they have more flexibility as well.
So you guys started with the micro lending, the micro loans portfolio, but now you offer a greater range of basic banking products, including, a basic day-to-day payments capability, equivalent to a debit card. You have savings capabilities. When did you start expanding that product profile?
Well, in fact, we have been playing around with a lot of different products early on. I mean, in 2015, we actually launched the WeBank app, where a customer can actually download the WeBank app from the Apple or Android App Store, and once they do the online KYC, just like do a quick facial scan verifying their identity, they can open up a WeBank account with us.
Does that link to Tencent's WeChat database?
No, that's actually separate from the Tencent ecosystems. separate from Tencent ecosystem. But for that particular product, we actually, as of today, we signed up close to 20 million customer base already. And then for those customers, they can actually start investing and buying wealth management products being offered by our partners with very low fees and low barrier of entry. And essentially, they can start investing from 1 RMB onwards and be able to accumulate interest along the way. And in 2018, we also started working with Tencent on a deposit product that tie up with the WeChat wallet. Because a lot of the WeChat wallet users, they are like small merchants. So essentially, they receive a lot of payments into their wallets, and those actually, the balance is not earning interest at all.
Right.
So what we come up with is we actually give them an offer to open up a WeBank account, and they can transfer the balance to the WeBank account, deposit account, and start earning interest.
Very low friction. Yeah.
Right. So that's a this is very appealing to a lot of the WeChat wallet users.
It's incredible how you've gone about this. So I want to give people a picture of the scale of the growth of your business right now. Tell us about some of the numbers in terms of total customers on the platform and the sort of day-to-day activity you have going through WeBank now.
Right. Well, the total effective customer base that we have is actually over 170 million.
Wow.
So,
incredible. That's in terms of customers, that makes you a bigger bank in terms of retail customers than JP Morgan Chase, right?
Yeah, but of course, I mean, we are talking about like these like small value transactions, right? So when compared to the bigger banks, I mean, the transaction volume in terms of the number of transactions that we handle is even higher, I would say. But the value may not be as high.
The value is low, but the transaction volume is higher. So that indicates that people will be using your service on a very regular basis, perhaps daily.
Exactly.
Yeah?
The monthly active user base is actually over 50% of the effective customer base that we have.
That's very impressive.
So these are like high frequency transaction users. And in terms of the number of transactions that we handle on a daily basis, I mean, we just had a new record a few days ago. We actually processed more than 490 million transactions in a single day.
That's incredible. Right. So this is why, if you guys are listening, this is why Forrester, one of the world's top independent research houses, said WeBank is the world's leading digital bank. They point out that WeBank's success lies in improving inclusiveness of financial services and basically the development of the whole financial inclusion movement in China, but it's through technology-driven innovation. It hasn't required a huge amount of national policy support, certainly hasn't been reliant on branches. This is a really strong proof point for the fact that technology can materially change the inclusion element of financial services globally. So tell me, Henry, in terms of the architecture you've got, you're also now starting to work with other banks around China. I've been in your control room in Shenzhen. It's incredibly impressive piece of technology architecture where you can monitor everything in real time. It sort of blows my mind as a challenger bank operator to see what you guys have done is amazing. So tell us a little bit about the technology that's been able to build this incredible digital bank.
Right. When we decided that we will be like focusing on promoting financial inclusion, we know that we need to have a very different cost structure. And in turns, I mean, in order to provide that kind of a cost structure, the technology architecture, the technology stack that we deploy has to be vastly different from a traditional bank. So we decided not to go with any proprietary technology. We decided that we will be leveraging cloud as much as possible, even though in China the regulators still mandate a bank to run only on private cloud. But we decided that, hey, we need to heavily deploy our architecture on cloud, only run on standardized, commoditized hardware, and leverage as much open source technology as possible. So we don't even buy commercial database technology. We run our mission critical applications on open source databases like MySQL or TidyDB, etc. And then by doing that, we are able to provide a very scalable, very flexible architecture, fully distributed, and also be able to drive down the cost substantially. I mean, just give you an idea. I mean, the 2018, we actually had a analysis on the IT operating cost per account. IT operating cost per year is already down to 3.6 RMB, which is equivalent to 50 US cents.
Yeah, that's
and
crazy.
We actually done that by taking away a lot of the, you know, the traditional banking IT architecture, and just revamp the whole thing from ground up. So building a fully in-house design, distributed architecture, and then be able to achieve that cost advantage. And if you compare to other traditional banks in China, they are probably paying 10 times that, 10 times of that.
Easily.
And
most banks are paying 1,000 times that in the United States, if not more.
Right. And this proved to be very important because just going back to the micro-lending example that we had, because people only borrow very small ticket size, very small loan size from us, and then they only borrow for a very short period of time. So in fact, 72% of the loan that we originate only generate less than 100 RMB in terms of interest. So,
right.
Which is equivalent to a 15 USD.
$15.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we did a quick calculation. I mean, if we actually adopt the traditional IT technology stack, I mean, we won't be able to make that kind of a business sustainable. So it turns out, I mean, this is the kind of key decision that you need to make upfront, right? Once you have the proper foundation in place, then your business will be able to sustain, right? Otherwise, I mean, it's not something that you can go for long term.
Absolutely. No, I agree. I think this sort of shows that if you actually want to get financial inclusion at scale, you really have to have this sort of from the ground up architectural approach, because otherwise it's you can't afford,
right.
the margins are too small.
Right.
So that's,
and even though we are actually like using a lot of these like low cost technology components, we are not sacrificing on the requirements on availability or security either. I mean, share with you some numbers. For the first half of this year, the availability of the whole architecture or the whole banking platform at WeBank, we achieved a availability number of 99.999%, which represent only like 5 minutes of time during the whole year that will have an impact on, you know, customer experience. Essentially, we are being able to achieve best of both worlds, right? Low cost, at the same time, very reliable, very stable foundation to run our business on.
Absolutely. Now, I know we're running out of time, Henry, so I just want to get to a couple more questions before we wrap up. The first is, you guys have broken a lot of ground. You did a lot of new things for the first time in China, if not the world. So tell me about the relationship you have with the regulators, the central bank in China.
We have very close relationship with our regulator. In fact, we actually have been working actively with our regulator and be able to understand a lot of their requirements, and at the same time let them understand what our innovation is about. And along the way, we also offer a lot of the technology capabilities to our regulator and help them build a lot of the RegTech solutions. By actually offering them these type of like leading edge capabilities, they will be able to do their job better. And along the way, we also are able to build up the trust between our regulator and ourselves. And it's actually beneficial to both sides.
And absolutely.
Yeah, and being
makes
able
a lot of sense.
Yeah, and we are able to like stay ahead of the game, and then also make sure that like we got support from our regulator instead of being like, scrutinized from them like on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. So you got a big week coming up next week. I know you guys are out at the Singapore FinTech Festival from November 11 to 13. In fact, you are presenting on in the digital transformation theme, the roundtable at 10:30 on November 11th, I understand. What are you going to be? What are you talking about at Singapore FinTech Festival?
We'll be sharing our digital transformation journey. So essentially, the idea behind digital banking kind of concepts that we have built up in China, and our experience, the actual experience implementing a digital bank in China, and hopefully that experience will be a good reference for the rest of the world. And also, as SFF, we'll be showcasing a lot of the technology capabilities that we have built up because, I mean, on one hand, we embrace open source technologies. We use a lot of open source technologies to build our technical architecture. But at the same time, since earlier this year, we started also a very important initiative. We try to contribute a lot of our technical capabilities back to the technical community as well. So as SFF, we'll be showing a lot of the open source products that we will be releasing to the market, or we have already released out to the market. So hopefully, our peers in the industry will be able to leverage those capabilities and started to build the next generation banking platform for themselves.
Very cool. Whole ganger. As we say in Canton. And see, this is unique because, you know, being in Shenzhen, you understand Cantonese as well as Putonghua Mandarin. So, this has been fantastic, Henry. I'll say to our listeners here, if you're going to be in Singapore, for the FinTech Festival, make sure you take the opportunity. This is the world's number one challenger bank in the world. They've developed this at scale. We're talking more than 170 million customers already. This sort of scale is only possible with the type of approach that we see, coming out of the challenges built from the ground up for this. So if you want to see get a glimpse into what banking around the world is going to be like in the 2020s and the 2030s, then this is it. So, Mazitao, Henry, thank you very much for joining us on Breaking Banks today, and we wish you all the continued success. You've built an incredible team there, and we enjoy the opportunity to work with you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brett. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Well, that's it for another episode of Breaking Banks. Thank you very much for joining us from one of the 180 countries around the world where we have our Breaking Bank listeners. If there's something you guys want to hear on the show, don't forget to tweet us out. Reach out to us on LinkedIn at Breaking Banks 1 on Twitter. You can go to Breaking Banks on LinkedIn. You can go to breakingbanks.com. And of course, if you're on Instagram at Breaking Banks as well, let us know what you'd like to hear. Tweet us out, give us a 5-star review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, wherever it is that you download the show. That helps people find our show more easily. I really appreciate that, and appreciate you being here to listen. We'll be back with another Breaking Banks again, the same time next week. Bye.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.